This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
Is it art or is it vandalism? It's the question being debated in Melbourne today, with another Pam the Bird appearing on a bridge this time after a standoff with police. So what do you think of this trademark image? Because some are condemning it, others are celebrating it. Is there a place for graffiti in our communities? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up in a bit, we're going to get into this debate.
People in their ivory tower love going over to museums and galleries, but this is the gallery of the street. This is the gallery of the battler.
There you go. Big thoughts there. I want to hear yours too. Is there a lot of graffiti where you live? You don't have to be in Melbourne. You could be in another city, another town across Australia. What do you think of it? What is vandalism? What is art? How do you define it? 0439 757 555. We're going to be getting to that soon. Later, it's 50 years of NAIDOC, and we're going to ask some First Nations Australians what it means to them. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that one as well. First, though.
This is Hack.
China test-fired a nuclear-capable intercontinental ballistic missile.
On Triple J.
Yeah, pretty dramatic announcement just hours after Australia signed a big new deal with Fiji. China launching a long-range missile test in the Pacific. Now, it's had leaders not just in Australia but around the world weighing in over the past 24 hours, warnings that this is a threat that Australia needs to take seriously. So how worried should we be? And what is the Prime Minister doing meeting with Pacific leaders this week? We're going to get into that in a bit. But first, Alice Angeloni has some detail.
This is a long-range missile test.
It has the potential to destabilise what is a very peaceful region.
It's incredibly unwelcome and concerning.
We cannot be naive about China.
Yesterday, China fired off an intercontinental ballistic missile test from a submarine into the Pacific. The nuclear-capable missile with the dummy warhead flew over Micronesia, Nauru and Kiribati and appears to have hit waters near Tuvalu's exclusive economic zone. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is in the Pacific and spoke from the Solomon Islands today.
There is no doubt that this is a provocative act by China, which does destabilise the region.
He says Australia wants to cooperate with China, but on this occasion, he disagrees.
It is standard procedure for tests such as this for there to be given 48 hours notice. This was not done on this occasion.
Alongside him was Solomon Islands PM Matthew Wale, who also criticised the action.
China's a good friend of Solomon Islands, but this is not something a friend does.
There's been a lot of reaction today. Shadow Defence Minister James Patterson on Channel 9.
China is engaging in behaviour which it knows is threatening, which it knows is coercive. One of the reasons why militaries conduct exercises like these is for the demonstration effect. They want others to know they've got the capability to do so.
And New Zealand's Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, told Radio New Zealand they're deeply concerned because it's the second ballistic missile test from China in the last few years.
We were informed, we weren't consulted, we were told literally a couple of hours before it actually took place.
He also noted that the region is nuclear free.
It militarises our region. It's inconsistent with Pacific values, and I think there's going to be quite a big pushback.
And on the other side of the globe, at a NATO conference in Turkey, Chief Mark Rutte reacted too.
This is why we have this close cooperation, because the theatres are getting more and more intertwined. What happens in the Indo-Pacific is relevant to what is happening in the transatlantic.
The test missile came just hours after Australia and Fiji signed a major new defence alliance in Suva yesterday. So what's the deal there?
The Ocean of Peace Agreement declares that both countries would both, quote, act to meet the common danger if the other comes under attack.
The landmark new alliance is also open to other Pacific nations with militaries. The ABC's Stephen Jedgetts has been in Suva.
What you've got are the two countries making very substantial and serious commitments to one another, which are comparable to the commitments that Australia and Papua New Guinea made to one another in the Puk Puk Treaty that was signed last year.
And what's China had to say about all of this? Well, it's warned Australia not to harm its interests in the Pacific, with China's Foreign Ministry spokeswoman, Mao Ning, issuing a response last night.
We do not engage in geopolitical rivalry or seek selfish political games. It's hoped that the country of concern
return will truly respect the independence of Pacific Island nations, focus on their sustainability, and avoid targeting any third party or harming the interest of any third party. And on the missile, Chinese state media reports the test was part of routine annual military training. And while the missile came soon after the Defence Pact was signed, it's not believed the two are connected. Here's Melissa Conley-Tyler from the University of Melbourne's Asia Institute.
I don't think that it's related to our agreement on the Ocean of Peace Initiative with Fiji. If you're thinking about who this is directed to, if anybody, I think it's much more about Japan, about Taiwan, about the countries that China is mostly signalling to.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Ali Angeloni reporting there, and some messages coming through. Someone saying, I'm more worried about needing defence against our neighbouring countries in the first place than not having the proper defence, that person says. Yeah, look, there's a lot of questions around what we've seen over the past 24 hours and what it means for us long term, whether we should be concerned by actions from China. So let's get into that more with Sam Roggeveen. He's the director of the International Security Program at the Lowy Institute, and he's been keeping across all of the developments. Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
Great, my pleasure.
How worried should we be here about China? Like, is Beijing really annoyed with Australia?
No, I don't think we should read this primarily through an Australia lens. China just tested a submarine-launched ballistic missile designed to carry nuclear warheads over thousands of kilometres. Now, that's sort of the apex capability that any nuclear-armed country can have. And it's designed almost solely with other nuclear-armed countries in mind, not middle powers like Australia. So I think this is a test, first of all, that's done for operational reasons. They need to make sure that their really sensitive equipment is safe and secure and will actually work when it's needed. But if there's a political subtext here, it's not aimed at Australia. It's really aimed at the United States and to a lesser extent to Russia as well, which is another nuclear-armed country.
Okay, because some have been reading this as a bit of a warning to Australia to maybe not interfere in the Pacific.
Yeah, I think that's because of the timing. I would regard that as a coincidence, really. Look, I guess it's possible that China could have delayed the test by a day or two, but equally, I mean, we can't know this, but equally, this could have been a test that took in all parts of the Chinese system right up to the leadership, in which case, you know, the dates are very hard to move. They would have been set months, even a year or more in advance. And so it's a pure coincidence that it happened to be conducted on this day.
I remember chatting to you last year, Sam, when there were some Chinese warships cruising off the coast of Australia. Have tensions eased since that point in time?
Yeah, a bit. Look, the government says that relations are normalising. They're not normal, but they're normalising. Certainly a lot of the heat that's been taken out of it since really the low that was in the period just before the Albanese government took office in 2022. The Chinese government at that time took the opportunity of the change of government to really set a new tone for the relationship. And I think that was a function of the fact that some of the coercive measures that they took against Australia, including, you know, economic measures against Australia, simply weren't working. And that's a credit to both Liberal-led and now Labor governments. The fact that they've, even though the temperature is lowered and even though the language of this current government is much softer than the previous government, the core policies really haven't changed, and neither government really gave in to Chinese demands.
Can we talk about this new pact we've signed with Fiji? How big of a deal is that?
Well, I think Australia's now signed a series of deals with Pacific Island countries, and they're certainly a very big deal to us. It's a real step change in Australian diplomacy in the Pacific, and the government can take a lot of credit for the fact that, you know, we're now in a new era in our relationship with the Pacific Island countries. At the core of it, and this is, you know, a sensitive issue in the Pacific, but at the core of it really is an Australian desire to prevent China from getting a real foothold in the region. We don't mind them giving aid and development assistance, which they do in pretty substantial amounts these days. But what Australia wants to avoid is any possibility that China ever establishes a permanent military presence in the Pacific Islands region, because, you know, one of Australia's big natural advantages is just geography. We're far away from China, and so it's very difficult for China to present a security threat to us. But if they've got a base in the Pacific, which we have a pretty good sense that they've tried to do before, if they ever got a base like that or several bases, then Australia's security would be compromised. And so the agreements that we signed with Fiji just recently, also PNG and other countries in the Pacific over the last year, are designed with preventing that at top of mind.
Do you think Beijing would be concerned about our allyship with the US and what could be influencing our movements in the Pacific?
I don't think our Pacific step up has happened at the instruction of the United States. I'm sure they're happy with it and they're encouraged by it. But I think this has been an Australian initiative. I certainly think China would be concerned by it. They do have their own interest to pursue in the Pacific, and Australia is trying to constrain the room that China has to move. And that's been pretty successful over the last few years. Australia's done a pretty good job in that regard. Now, China can always increase its effort in the Pacific. The difference, though, is that for Australia, the Pacific Islands is always a top priority, or at least it should be. And over the last few years, it certainly has been. For China, it's at best a second or third order priority. It's not top of mind.
All right. On the text line, someone says, I think we're overthinking it. China did not do this because of us. That was Mo talking about that missile test. Interesting. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese speaking with Sam Roggeveen from the Lowy Institute. And we're talking about Australia's new deal with Fiji and China's reaction, what it could mean for security in the Pacific going forward. Sam, the Solomon Islands Prime Minister says we need a Pacific-wide pact to counter China. Do you see that happening at all?
Well, up until very recently, I would have said no, but since this idea has been raised by Pacific Island countries themselves and evidently with some encouragement or support from Australia, then I think the chances of it have really improved, and I think it would be a good thing. You know, we shouldn't mistake this for what it is. It's not, even though we refer to it as a sort of mutual defence agreement, and that's the substance of what Australia has signed with now with Fiji, with PNG and others as well. The Pacific Island countries themselves don't bring a lot of military capability. They have very small defence forces. And so what this is really about is the point I made earlier, which is about excluding China. I would argue it is as much in the interests of the Pacific Island countries as it is in Australia's interests to exclude China from having a really strong military and diplomatic presence in the Pacific Islands region. So if a regional security pact helps to bring that about, then I think so much the better.
How much is China building up its military capability at the moment? Because I know the Lowy Institute has looked into this recently.
Yep, I published a report on this just last week. It's really the biggest military modernization of any country since the Second World War. It's very substantial, and probably the most sobering aspect of it is that in pure budgetary terms, they're barely breaking a sweat. They're spending about 2% of GDP. America, by contrast, spends a little under 3.5% of its GDP on defence. So China's still got plenty of room to move if it wants to spend even more and go even faster in its military modernisation. Now, as I said, China's a long way from Australia, so there's only so much of that overall power that it could bring to bear on against Australia if it ever wanted to attack us, in the unlikely event that they ever want to attack us. But still, it's a real concern for Australia and something we should be responding to.
Yeah, because there has been, you know, talk about this in previous years about the capability of China, about the threat of China potentially coming after Australia at some point. You're saying it's not something that's likely to happen anytime soon, but do we know if the capability is there to reach the Australian mainland?
There is some capability to reach the Australian mainland. So it's very clear from the style of the military build-up over the last, let's say, couple of decades, that reaching targets over thousands of kilometres away, like Australia, is not the top priority. It's certainly there. They have developed those capabilities and they already have certain missile systems that could reach the north of Australia with conventional weapons, and they could reach all of Australia with nuclear weapons if they ever wanted to. But that's not their only priority. So obviously Taiwan is a big issue, and that doesn't need those long-range kind of weapon systems that they would require to reach Australia. Last year, of course, we had the circumnavigation of Australia by a Chinese naval flotilla, and that was itself a little indicator and a little warning for Australia about what's ahead. Chinese capability is going to grow further, and there's more of that to come.
So how tricky is it going to be for Australia to manage all these relationships in the next few decades? We've got the United States, we've got China, we've got our Pacific neighbours. Is it a really hard balancing act we've got to achieve here?
Yeah, I think it's the hardest thing we've ever done, at least since World War II. It's the most challenging situation that Australia's ever faced, because historically, we've always been in the lucky position where our major economic partner in the world has also been our major military and strategic partner. First, the United Kingdom, and then, of course, the United States. In the 70s, we had Japan as our major economic partner, and that was an ally of the United States. So we've always been lucky in that regard, but that's now changed. We've got China's our major trading partner, and it has foreign policy interests which are directly contrary to those of our major security partner, the United States. In fact, China ultimately probably wants to push the United States out of Asia altogether. So, yeah, the most difficult thing we've ever done. And I'm not yet confident that we've really thought through the full implications of that challenge.
Any priorities you think should be on the list for Australia?
Yeah, I think Australia has to think much more deeply about self-reliance. The government does think about that a lot. But I would want to start from a basis of what I call dual scepticism. That is, we need to be sceptical about China's objectives, which are far-reaching, and they do want to overturn the prevailing US-led strategic order. But we should be sceptical about America too, and that's the piece of the puzzle that hasn't really fallen into place with this government or the last government, is that they continue to believe and continue to plan on the basis that the United States will always be there for us. I don't think that's a safe assumption. I don't think the United States has the resources or has the political will to maintain its position as the leading power in Asia. We are still planning, and AUKUS is, of course, at the centre of this. We are planning for a future in which the United States will always be there for us. We're making a massive bet on the United States. And I say Australia needs to bet on itself instead.
Sam Roggeveen from the Lowy Institute, really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
Great. Thank you so much.
We've got a few messages coming through. Someone saying, I think we should be more friendly with China than the US. Another person saying, doesn't the USA's policies contradict with ours? Someone else thinking Penny Wong is an absolute weapon and deserves more praise, that person saying. And Cody on the text line, he messaged in before saying, we send a politician, they send an army. But has since messaged in again and says, I actually kept listening to that chat and I've changed my mind on the matter. Disregard previous text. So, yeah, that's what we do at Hack. We're changing minds and getting information out there. All right, we're going to move on to some big drama in Melbourne today.
Hack.
I'm not coming down until they lower the taxes. F***ing sick of paying that shit.
As we speak, a man is at the top of the Balti Bridge having stamped Pam all over it.
Oh, I'm really dead against it. I think it's a complete joke.
It's unacceptable.
He's asking people to deliver him food by drone.
I want a peanut butter and jam sandwich and a glass of milk or I'm not coming down.
On Triple J.
Pam the bird. Is it art? Is it vandalism? Do you even know what I'm talking about? If you're in Melbourne, you definitely do. There's no way you haven't heard of or seen this image pop up around the city. And this morning, a new addition leading to a bit of drama, as you just heard, and the arrest of a 22-year-old. Now, he's been charged with 13 offences, including burglary, criminal damage, conduct endangering life, along with some graffiti charges. So let's find out a bit more with one of Hack's reporters in Melbourne, Jason Katsaris. Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
G'day, good to be here.
What happened this morning?
Yeah, well, there was a bit of a standoff this morning. It went for about 9 hours in Melbourne CBD after a man scaled one of the Balti Bridge, there's two massive towers on the bridge in Docklands, and spray-painted a giant Pam the Bird tag, caused traffic chaos. And just if you're not familiar, these towers on the bridge are about 140 metres tall. They're massive. And so it was a very visible event, a bit of a standoff that was going for quite a while.
I can imagine there would have been a lot of people, you know, watching and keeping across this on socials as well. I mean, what is Pam the Bird for people that don't know?
Well, Pam the Bird is like a cartoon bird, like sometimes two, sometimes four little legs. It's a bit of a strange-looking creature, but it's appeared on a bunch of different buildings all over Melbourne, appeared on railway carriages, some heritage buildings. It's really been going for some years. But the bloke who was actually found on top of this tower this morning was actually online posting to social media about being up there during the entire incident, I guess. And so people were actually tuning in and following this account called Pam the Bird as it was happening. And he was making all these demands, I guess, which were pretty funny, asking for sandwiches and milk and blankets. So it was just a wild, wild affair. But eventually he was, he came down of his own accord and was arrested.
So have we heard anything from police?
Yeah, so we've heard from police. They've sort of condemned the entire incident. They've said it was, you know, it took a whole lot of specialist police resources and police from both night shift and day shift all there sort of checking on this guy, trying to get him down safely and keeping the public safe at the same time, as well as if you're a commuter, it would have been, I suppose, pretty irritating having that bottleneck on an arterial road. But the ABC and other media outlets have sort of pinned down that this is allegedly Jack Gibson Burrell who's been arrested. He's previously been arrested for Pam the Bird alleged incidents in the past, and he's up for dozens of charges on vandalism and trespass relating to other incidents where the Uncle Toby's silo in Melbourne was vandalised.
Yeah, well, let's hear from Acting Inspector Darren Wallace, who had this to say earlier.
Our message is don't do it. It costs the taxpayer. It's the taxpayer that has to pay. We all want to live in a nice environment. We don't want graffiti everywhere.
So that's the police there, Jason. What about the Melbourne community? Have people had much to say about what's happened today and what's happened previously?
Yeah, it's a funny one here in Melbourne because to a lot of people, Pam the Bird has become a bit of an icon. It's, you know, a relatively benign looking tag, but because it's, you know, appeared on some heritage listed buildings and including the Flinders Street Station and also the Clifton Hill Shot Tower, and that's had to be paid for by taxpayers and council ratepayers, it has also angered a lot of people too. So it's kind of divided the community in a big way. But, you know, if you look on social media, you'll see lots of accounts and lots of people chiming in and saying, save Pam the Bird or leave it there and let's put some clear coat over that and leave it forever.
There's definitely a lot of people who are against this, who are really outraged by what is happening across Melbourne. But then, as you say, there are some who have supported it. Here's one caller to ABC Radio this morning.
I love graff. I love graffiti. I went up to Sydney a couple of weeks ago and I was seeing bomb trains, tags everywhere, and I absolutely loved it. It's the art of the street. You know, people in their ivory tower love going over to museums and galleries, and I like doing that stuff too. But this is the gallery of the street. This is the gallery of the battler. This is the art of lower socioeconomic Australia, and I absolutely love it. And I can't wait to see more graffiti, more bomb trains, more tags. I've got more respect for the bloke getting around with a permanent marker doing tags on a train than some bloke doing art on a permission wall.
So there you go. Some people love it, Jason. Some people hate it. But thank you for keeping us across what has been a really busy morning in Melbourne. Hack reporter Jason Katsaris, really appreciate your time.
No worries. Thank you.
And unsurprisingly, a lot of different opinions on the text line now. Someone saying that bird is not art. Someone else saying tagging is ugly, but I don't mind some graffiti. And Pam the Bird has made an iconic statement and I support it. We've got Jack on the line with us. Jack's in Melbourne. Jack, what do you make of it all?
So I'm all for Pam the Bird. I do think I also need to say I'm not the same Jack.
You're not the same Jack.
I'm not the same Jack. But I do find it interesting because I feel I appreciate the iconicness around Pam the Bird, but I also find it quite hypocritical that we are so negative towards the Pam the Bird, but then there's other artists like Banksy who people pay millions of dollars for his graffiti art.
Yeah, I mean, and that's been some of the argument that we've heard over the last few years that, you know, Banksy is allowed to maybe get away with a bit more than others are. Look, there are many, many people who are saying we can't have damage to historic buildings especially, and they don't like the look of it, but then you have others like Jack who like it. So heaps of opinions there. We're going to move on.
Hack. The 2026 NAIDOC Week theme is 50 Years of Deadly.
On Triple J.
Yeah, it is NAIDOC Week, and this is a big one, the 50th anniversary. So it's time to take a look at what half a century of deadly means across generations. And Shannon Schubert's been speaking to some First Nations leaders.
Just reflecting on 1967, we weren't even recognised as people in the population in the census. Now we've got a treaty in Victoria, so we've come a long way.
For Gundi Tamara, Karai Wurrung, Jabwurrung man Uncle Troy Austin, there's extra reason to celebrate this NAIDOC.
Well, we fought for it for a long time. I was the ATSIC Commissioner for Victoria back in the early 2000s, and yeah, the theme back then was treaty, let's get it right.
Wemba Wemba, Yorta Yorta, Muddy Muddy and Barapa Barapa woman Jetta Atkinson-Costa agrees that this year it's a historic NAIDOC.
This year is really special because it's our first NAIDOC week with a treaty being signed between First Peoples and government. And that's something that generations of our elders have fought for, and now we've got it.
NAIDOC has now been going for 50 years, and this year's theme is about celebrating that, with 50 years of deadly. Across the different generations, NAIDOC means celebrating the survival of the world's oldest continuous living cultures.
When I think about NAIDOC, I think about the warm community gatherings, the basketball tournaments, talent shows, and I picture a beautiful big sea of people flooding city streets of Melbourne at the NAIDOC march with red, black and yellow and Torres Strait Islander colours.
But what's now a celebration was once a day of mourning.
Governments dispossessed Aboriginal people for a second time. As thriving Aboriginal communities were dismantled, oppressive restrictions implemented, and children were forcibly removed, Aboriginal activism began to emerge.
While the rest of Australia was celebrating the 150th anniversary of the landing of the First Fleet, a group of Aboriginal elders in 1938 marched through Sydney CBD to protest the widespread racism and mistreatment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
And Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders say it's really important to reflect on that during NAIDOC.
It's recognised as one of the first national civil rights, Aboriginal civil rights movements in this country. So even though it's a time of celebration, it's always important to acknowledge its origins and reflect on that and just how far we've come.
Today celebrates the beginning of treaty, the first in Australia's history.
In November last year, the Victorian government signed a treaty with the First Peoples Assembly. It came into effect in December, and in May this year, Galang Wa was established, an entity including democratically elected First Nations people to work with the Victorian government on matters that affect First Peoples.
Went off the national scene for a little while, but we kept pushing as a community right across Australia for a voice, and finally to be a part of it and sign the treaty last year in November and celebrate in December, just really made it all worthwhile and get on with the business of implementing it.
Victoria is the only state in Australia to sign a treaty with its First Peoples. But on a federal level, Australia remains the only Commonwealth country not to have signed one at all.
Victoria has been leading the way in the treaty space for the past decade, and it's my hope that other states across the country follow suit and sign treaties with their traditional owners.
Uncle Troy Austin thinks NAIDOC is also a good time to talk about the issues facing First Nations communities and have tough conversations.
Yeah, there is a need to continue to put the issues on the table, and things like Invasion Day or Survival Day is important because I think personally that needs to be changed. Be able to have a place in the community where we're celebrated for that week. We need to celebrate Aboriginal people all year round.
For Jetta, she's proud of Victoria's treaty, and she's grateful to the generations who came before and fought for the rights of First Nations peoples.
I just think it's always so important to acknowledge that struggle, because without them, we wouldn't have arrived at this point where First Nations culture is being more embraced. We've still got a long way to go, but it's definitely the contrast between the times that they lived through and now is different. So I'm full of gratitude for the fight that my ancestors put up when it was unpopular and unsafe to do so.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Shannon Schubert reporting there. And yeah, we'll have another chat with an leader in the Indigenous community coming up on Thursday to help mark NAIDOC Week. Also still hearing from so many people on Pam the Bird, story we brought you earlier. Someone's saying, I love Pam, it's gorgeous. Another person saying, it's trash, it's not an icon. Someone else saying, did he get his sandwich and milk in the end? I don't think so. And someone else saying, I like street art and certain graffiti. I think it has a place, but I don't like it on historic buildings, which seems to be what a lot of people are saying. It depends where it is, not on every building. All right, that is all we've got time for on Hack for now. Hack.